DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be joined by Dr. Robert George, who is a visiting professor at Harvard Law School and McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence and director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton University. He is a member of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom and previously served on the President's Council on Bioethics and as a presidential appointee to the United States Commission on Civil Rights. He is a former Judicial Fellow at the Supreme Court of the United States, where he received the Justice Tom C. Clark Award. He is a recipient of the United States Presidential Citizens Medal and the Honorific Medal for the Defense of Human Rights of the Republic of Poland. With Dr. Robert George, we go inside the pages of What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense, published by Encounter Books. Dr. George, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be on your show.
What is marriage? Man and woman, a defense. Have we really come to the point where we have to have a defense for that significant relationship?
Yes, it seems that we have come to such a point. An entire wing of the culture and one of our major political parties has decided to ditch the traditional historic understanding of marriage as a conjugal union, that is, as a union of husband and wife, and to substitute a new and really unprecedented understanding of marriage, or so-called marriage, which is the idea of marriage as merely a sexual romantic partnership, an especially intense form of companionship, characteristically with a sexual dimension. So with now, 11 states, something like that, having redefined marriage, radically redefined it to eliminate the element of sexual complementarity, to create what's sometimes called genderless marriage. With 11 states having done it or being on the verge of doing it, we need to defend the institution of marriage as a truly conjugal partnership.
We've lost the sense of what the definition of the word truly means, haven't we?
Well, we've truly lost the definition of the word marriage, at least in certain sectors of the culture and very influential elite sectors of the culture. And as I say, one whole political party now is completely on board with the idea of redefining marriage as a form of sexual romantic domestic partnership. So we've lost that. There's, of course, a lot of skepticism out there about the idea of moral truth, but often I find that the people who express skepticism about moral truth are quite certain that they understand and have the truth about things like human rights, tolerance, diversity, the need to combat discrimination, equality. So out of one side of their mouths, they say, well, who's to say what the truth is? And on the other side, they assert what they believe to be true quite insistently and perfectly willing to impose it on the whole culture.
Doesn't this really go down to a complete break of our appreciation of what the natural law is and a fundamental understanding of how that operates in the world?
Yeah, I think that we have as a culture to a very significant extent bought into a philosophy of life, a philosophy of the meaning of life, that contradicts the classical and Christian understanding that we sometimes call natural law thinking or natural law philosophy. The philosophy that we have to some extent bought into is sometimes called expressive individualism. It's the idea that what matters in life is the individual getting what he wants, getting satisfactions, psychological, emotional satisfactions. And that's really what it's all about. So we should be about the business of doing that and licensing any kind of behavior so long as it accomplishes or enables people to accomplish that goal of satisfaction seeking in a way that doesn't interfere with what they then will refer to as the rights of others. When we ask where those rights come from in the context of expressive individualist philosophy, however, there's no very good answer to that question. So they generate a question. This philosophy generates a question. What is the nature and basis of our rights and our freedoms? But it can't give an answer to that question in the way that the more traditional view, the natural law philosophy that's been so important historically in Western ethics can do.
I think it's so important that in this particular work that you've brought forward in What is Marriage, Man and Woman, a Defense, that it becomes between two tracks of thought. One, seeing marriage as the conjugal union as opposed to marriage as the emotional union.
Yes, that's right. And here's what the difference is. People who believe, as not only the Christian Church has historically taught, not only the Jewish tradition, but classical philosophers such as Plato and Aristotle, Plutarch, Musonius, Eastern traditions, even people like Mahatma Gandhi, for people who believe that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, we certainly believe that marriage has an important emotional or psychological dimension. But it's not merely an emotional union. What makes marriage distinctive, what sets it apart from other forms of emotional relationship, the relationship of ordinary friends, of family members, and so forth, is that it has a central bodily component. Mm-hmm. Bodily union of husband and wife is made possible by the sexual reproductive complementarity of male and female. And the historic tradition, again, not only among Christians, not only in the West, the historic tradition has understood that bodily union made possible by sexual reproductive complementarity in what we've always known as conjugal or marital acts is of profound personal significance. It's a personal meaning because the body is not merely an extrinsic instrument of the person where the person is considered as the emotional center or the center of consciousness or desire, but the body is part of the personal reality of the human being. So the complete union of persons, the comprehensive union of persons, which marriage uniquely is a union of persons at all levels of being, the emotional, the volitional, rational, the spiritual, but also the biological, the bodily. And it's bodily union that is at the foundation of the marital relationship, the conjugal relationship. And that explains something that's otherwise inexplicable, which is why marriage has historically always been understood as being consummated by sexual acts, as being consummated by acts that fulfill the behavioral conditions of procreation. And those acts retain their status as marital acts, as reproductive type acts, as acts that complete marriages, even where the non-behavioral conditions of procreation happen not to obtain. Which again explains why historically, and not merely in the Christian tradition, we've always understood that even the marriage of people, men and women, who know that they're infertile and can't have children are nevertheless true marriages.
That complementarity between the male and the female coming together in that fundamental union lays down the building block then for the family, which is an essential element in all societies.
Yes, and that explains something else about marriage historically. Unlike ordinary friendships, in which law and the state took no particular interest and didn't take cognizance of, and unlike ordinary sacraments like baptisms or religious events like bar mitzvahs, in which the law and the state didn't take any cognizance, unlike those, marriage has always been considered a vital matter of interest to the public. So the law has, in a great many cases across various societies, regulated marriage, recognized marriage, promoted marriage, gotten itself involved in issues having to do with dissolution of marriage, and so forth and so on. When men and women get together, pretty soon you're going to start having children. Mm-hmm. And it's the reproductive, the procreative dimension of marriage. It's because marriage is a uniquely apt partnership for the rearing of children. It's for that reason that the state has its interest in marriage, and why law treats marriage differently than it treats ordinary friendships or relationships between siblings religious matters like bar mitzvahs and baptisms.
We're talking with Dr. Robert George about a book that he's co-authored with several others. The title is What is Marriage, Man and Woman, a Defense? Dr. George, in this book, you make a very strong point that this is not an argument against homosexuality or several other arguments. This is more about the defense of the institution of marriage.
Yeah, I mean, this is a book about what marriage is. Today we hear lots of people saying, we need to redefine marriage to include same-sex partners because equality requires that, or fairness requires that.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is, since some types of relationship will be recognized as marriage and others will not be recognized as marriage, there will always be lines drawn, distinctions drawn between the marital and the non-marital. And so the question is, when are those distinctions arbitrary and when are they not? They're only unfair or violations of equality when they are arbitrary. And so, to understand whether a distinction is arbitrary or not, we need to ask a prior question, which it seems nobody on the side that wishes to redefine marriage ever wants to face up to, and we want to force them to face up to it, and that is the question that is the title of our book, What is Marriage? We have challenged people on the other side time and time again over several years now to give us an answer to the question, what is marriage? We have stated what we believe marriage to be, what marriage historically has been considered to be. They need to come forward with an answer to that question. We believe that there is no question, no answer to that question that they could give consistently with their own positions that will explain why marriage is a sexual partnership at all, as opposed to a partnership that might as well be integrated around other non-sexual shared interests or activities like playing tennis or reading novels or what have you. Their view cannot explain why marriage is the union of two persons and not three or more in polyamorous groups. They can appeal only to sentiment and subjective preference, which are obviously not good enough to make a principled argument. They cannot explain why marriages should be closed rather than open, that is, sexually closed, that only the spouses should have sexual relations only with each other and not with people outside the partnership. Nor can they explain why marriage is a relationship that involves at least a pledge of permanence and isn't simply a temporary partnership pledged to obtain for as long as love lasts or what have you. So I think we know very well why they will not rise to our challenge, why they will not meet our challenge, why they won't even try to meet our challenge of giving us their definition of what marriage is. It's because if they do that, they realize that the whole concept of marriage, all the traditional norms associated with marriage, including those that people still want to hang on to, would fall apart.
Isn't part of the problem that in this discussion of defining what marriage is, that because it addresses in its scope the same-sex union, that it also in that scope would have to address areas like no-fault divorce?
Yes, that's right. It's very interesting. I am only one of many marriage activists who came into the marriage movement long before we had any debate about same-sex anything, including certainly the idea that marriage could be redefined to include same-sex partners. I came into the movement as a young scholar in the early 80s. I joined people like Maggie Gallagher and David Blankenhorn to fight against the pathologies that were, social pathologies, that were eroding the marital culture, the culture of marriage, including no-fault divorce, very centrally, no-fault divorce. We were fighting against no-fault divorce and the divorce culture generally. We were fighting against the trend toward cohabitation, sexual cohabitation, outside of the matrimonial bond. We could see already the damage this was having in our society, harming the marriage culture, and thereby harming children and really the whole of society. That's what brought us into the movement. We were not focused. It was no same-sex relations was no central issue of ours. We all had our own moral opinions about the matter. But the debate was, and in my mind still is, fundamentally about what marriage is. And it seems to me that the only coherent understanding of marriage that we can put forward is the idea of marriage as a truly conjugal partnership, not something that is reduced to mere emotional bonding, companionship.
And as you so beautifully stated earlier, the reason why the state took upon itself to be involved in that definition, it's because it did have benefits for the society and the culture in which the state serves. And so it seems as though the economic areas and so many other places where this institution of marriage affects society should be a part of the discussion outside of even the religious aspects or the spiritual aspects in which many are concerned with.
Oh, that's certainly true. Marriage is a pre-political institution. It precedes the state. It even precedes the church. I mean, neither the state nor the church created marriage. Now, from the believer's point of view, like all things, like all institutions, like human beings itself, there's a sense in which marriage is created by God. But marriage is pre-political and, in a certain sense, pre-religious, even before we have a church or a people of Israel or anything like that. We have marriage, and the Christian tradition certainly has recognized marriages, the validity of marriages, among non-Christians, people who've never heard of the gospel, people who are not themselves religious believers. Marriage is, in that sense, a natural reality. But it's of profound social significance. It's not simply an individual choice. It's not simply an individual matter or something of significance only to the individuals who are involved or their families. It's of profound importance to the whole of society because it's the fundamental unit of society on which everything else depends. Consider this. So many institutions, all the other institutions of society, rely on something that they cannot produce. I'm talking here about business firms, the legal system, the political system, educational institutions, what have you. All of them rely on there being large numbers of basically honest, decent, hardworking people, not perfect, but people who will do the right thing most of the time for the right reasons and not out of fear of punishment for lawbreaking or something like that, who will show up for work on time, not drunk, not on drugs, who won't steal, who can basically be trusted. All the institutions of society depend on having such people, but none of those institutions can produce them. Business firms don't produce such people. They don't do the work of actually formation, of forming people to be morally decent. The legal system doesn't do that. It can only be a backstop when things go wrong. The political system doesn't do that. For the most part, educational institutions don't do that. Who carries that burden? Who plays the central role in forming decent people so that the whole of society can flourish? The family. And the family is based on marriage. And where the marriage-based family breaks down, we now have plenty of evidence. Look at any place it's happened where the marriage-based family breaks down. Pretty soon, all those social pathologies that we've been concerned about, delinquency, drug abuse, violence, criminality, come in the wake of the breakdown of the family, basically because of fatherlessness, the parental influences, not simply of a mother, but also of a father that in large numbers you need in order to have a decent society. Now, that's not to say that individual single parents can't do a great job. They are heroes. They struggle hard. They, in many cases, do a great job. Mm-hmm. But we know in the aggregate, we know from the averages, we know from the statistics, this is no longer a matter of speculation, that where you have widespread family breakdown and fatherlessness, where that becomes the norm, you're going to get a breakdown of the social fabric, and you're going to get all those terrible social pathologies that harm everybody, the individuals who are involved in them, and everybody else. You also get the following. You get the end of any hope of limited government, because government has to come in where the family breaks down in its health, education, and welfare functions to provide the social support and the social services that are needed for people, and also the policing that comes with the social pathologies and crime. And so you get the growth of government and the impossibility of really keeping government to a limited role.
This is why it's so important, not so much to wag a finger, as you've stated, essentially, at those families that have broken down, but to go back and look at why it broke down, and maybe because there was a lack of understanding of what is marriage. And we have to have that clear definition before us, before we even enter into those unions in the first place.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the real tragedy of no-fault divorce is that it taught people a falsehood about what marriage is. It began to erode people's understanding of what marriage is, and it led people to believe that marriage is just an emotional union that has its validity and importance for as long as there's an intense emotional bond, and where you're no longer feeling an intense emotional bond, there's no point in staying in the relationship and working on it and trying to restore it. The problems that have created our current dilemma were not brought on by same-sex attracted people or homosexuality or anything like that. The very idea that two people of the same sex could be married, that marriage is merely an emotional bond, is made possible by the erosion of the understanding of what marriage is, which was caused by things like no-fault divorce, widespread cohabitation, the marginalization of marriage, the trivialization of marriage, all of which was basically caused by people who were in opposite-sex relationships. So we shouldn't be blaming same-sex-attracted people, even those people who are clamoring for a redefinition of marriage. I mean, I understand certainly where they're coming from. The fault here predates this current debate over same-sex marriage. This is really a consequence of the debate. But it's very important for a true marriage, the true understanding of marriage, to prevail in this debate, because once we've defined marriage away, it will be impossible to be about the business that really set me to work in the marriage movement. That is the business of restoring an authentic, healthy, flourishing marriage culture. If marriage is redefined away and officially becomes merely a matter of emotional bonding, then there's no hope of going back and reforming the bad so-called reforms like no-fault divorce, which have done so much harm.
Yeah, and it's, again, so very important in any type of discussion or debate on this particular issue is to have that grounding in basic principles. And because of the male-female component, that conjugal union, when someone presents a different type of argument to try to derail the discussion, for example, when they put in the laws that the state imposed on biracial relationships or biracial marriages, that was about a different issue. You can go back and say, because marriage is male-female, that was a bigotry type of law. It wasn't about the interruption of that conjugal union.
Oh, yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, the idea that the conjugal understanding of marriage is based on prejudice akin to the racist prejudice that resulted in laws against interracial marriage is just silly. I mean, it's a silly, ridiculous idea, and it shouldn't be given much attention. The reality is that the old racists, like the modern liberals in their own way, just were simply trying to redefine marriage as something other than a conjugal union. They tried to bring a new dimension, a new requirement in that has nothing to do with the conjugal nature of marriage, and that is race. Race has nothing to do with conjugal marriage. Introducing it was just an effort to change marriage from what it was, a conjugal union, into something else, something having to do with racial purity. Contemporary liberals are trying to change marriage, too. They're trying to alter the conjugal definition. They're about the business of trying to redefine marriage. What I say to both the racists and the liberals is stop trying to redefine marriage. Marriage is about the conjugal union of husband and wife, one of each. Race is totally irrelevant to it. Gender is very relevant and very central.
Well, Dr. George, I wish we had more time to have the discussion, but that's what's so wonderful about having what is marriage, man and woman, a defense. Any final thoughts in these closing
Well,
minutes?
I just want to, I hope people will read the book. It's short and readable. It's also very inexpensive, and I want to congratulate my two brilliant young co-authors, Sharif Girgis and Ryan Anderson, just outstanding, accomplished young people who did the bulk of the work, really, on this book. So I want to give them a shout-out and a salute.
Thank you so much for all the work and everything that you have done and will do, I'm sure, in the future on helping us to understand what is marriage. Dr. Robert George.
Much appreciated. Thank you.
God bless.
You too.
With Dr. Robert George, we've gone inside the pages of What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to EncounterBooks.com. The website for its publisher, Encounter Books, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of DiscerningHearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, Insights from Today's Most Compelling Authors.